Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode number 41 of the Beyond the Ring with Big T Wrestling Podcast. And we are here for Thursday night, January 26, 2017. I'm your host, Big T, and I have a very, very special guest right here with me tonight. He is a professional wrestling legend, wrestled all around the world, most famously for his time in WCW. We have with us tonight Mr. Buff the Stuff Bagwell. How you doing, Buff?
Hey, man. What's going on, brother? Thanks for having me on.
Hey, you're welcome. Anytime. I'm glad that I could get you on the show, and thank you for accepting the invitation.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think where I want to start off this interview with you is tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, your training and what got you in to, like, what made you make the life decision that I want to be a professional wrestler. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life, and then going on to training and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about the early days.
That's actually a great, great question and a great way to ask it for me, because my way of getting into professional wrestling is really very, very different than the most of all wrestlers, the way they got into it. And the way I got into it was, my parents were filthy rich. I was lucky enough to be a very rich, boy, from his parents being well off with the lumber business in the 70s and 80s. And, so I grew up a very rich child, and, you know, I had the absolute luckiness, you know, and fortunate enough, which it's unbelievable, you know, it's to be able to, you know, have a parents that, you know, well, I grew up in the big house, and we went to each year, whatever grade I was in, it was going to Bagwell's house and the pool party, and, you know, we had a tanning bed before there was even tanning salons. I mean, just things like that we had, and four-wheelers, and we were rednecks with money, which was very dangerous. But we also, along with being rednecks for money, we also were very classy, very well-mannered, very, very respectful. I was raised under a very strict, you know, household of, I mean, we got everything we wanted, but we took care of it. If we didn't, we got it taken away. I mean, I can remember actually armor-alling my motorcycle tires. I mean, that's no joke. And just repainting my go-kart if I had a chip in it or something. I mean, we took care of our stuff. And we cared about our items, and we were taught to take care of our items. And, warming up, I remember my father's a drag racer, and older people will know this saying, but, you know, there used to be a thing on cars called a catalytic converter. I mean, excuse me, it was an automatic choke is what it was. And you would get in your car, and you, how old are you, by the way?
I am 28 years old. Actually, I will be 29 next month.
You do not know about this, then, but I can't remember what the actual name of it is. But you get in your car back in the old days, I can't tell you what year, 1986. So 1986, you get in your car, so from around that time and probably a little bit before, there was a choke, and it was called an automatic choke, and it was on vehicles. And you got in your car, and before you cranked it, you just one time floored your gas pedal one good hard time. Then you cranked your car, and your car idled at a very high level for about 2 minutes, and then you'd hit it one more time, and the choke would come off, and you'd hear your RPMs come down, and it was called an automatic choke. My father, being a drag racer and coming from the kind of household here that I came from, if he didn't hear that automatic choke go off at my Jeep every morning on the way to school, I got my ass listening, and I have to do the automatic choke on my Jeep, even if I was running late for school, because I get in trouble. So, very, very long story short, very well respected, very, you know, raised properly, you know, all that stuff, but we were rich. So we were going to go into, we were all going to work for my brothers, my father's water company. So my brothers, when they graduated, they worked for my dad and mom, and it was called Southeastern Building Supply. And then in 1988, when I was graduating, they went broke, and it was pretty quick. It was around late 87, 88, they went broke, and the reason it was all of a sudden is because my mother was kind of hiding it from my dad, because she got in a little bit of trouble, a little bit of a bind, and when she finally was fruitful and showed him the whole paperwork, no fixing it. So, we went under pretty quick, and my dad said, look, I got, you know, to put all you guys into something what y'all want to do. Well, what do you want to do when you're 18? I don't know. I have no idea what I learned to do. And back to the wrestling thing, I would say 90% of every pro wrestler that made it to the WCW or the WWF, I would say 90% of those wrestlers wanted to be a wrestler, watched wrestling as a kid, dressed up at least once at Halloween to be some kind of wrestler. And all they did was talk about wrestling and wrestle in the backyard, and they wanted to be a professional wrestler. Well, that wasn't me. We watched it as a Southern redneck type family. I remember on Sunday nights watching Gordon Solie, and we went to a little TBS. You know, 25, 30 people there, and the Road Warriors would come out and kill somebody, and Ric Flair would come out. I mean, I remember it, but I remember my brother dressing up like Dusty Rhodes, which years later, he would be the one that hired me in 1990. But, I never dressed up like one. I played around in yards like one, but I never it's just very weird to get in this business and not from the time you were a little kid dream about being a pro wrestler. So, I'm not thinking about pro wrestling, I'm not being a pro wrestler, what do you want to do? My parents are going broke. My brother picked a gym, my middle brother picked a drywall company, and I picked massage therapy. At 18, what do you really want to do? I had a 1.8 grade point average because I was going to work for my parents. I didn't care what my grade point average was. All I wanted to do was graduate.
Yeah.
So I graduated. I was a super athlete, but I wasn't going to go to school. I tore my hamstring real bad my junior year in football, really bad. And so sports professional level wise was out of the question. So the lumberyard was where I was going to be with my brothers. And when that went under, I was 18 and didn't know. So I thought maybe with the massage therapy, I could go to sports medicine, you know, sports training, something sports. I wanted to do something sports. And so I go to massage therapy school. It was a 10-month class. 9 to 4 every Monday through Friday, a full college prep anatomy physiology course. It was no joke. They were really trying to clean it up at the time. They went from the word masseuse to massage therapist. You know, they really tried to clean it up and everything. And I remember being in school with a bunch of like peace, love, you know, real friendly people. And here I am, you know, tanning and tanning beds and working out in gyms, and nobody in there even knew what a tanning bed was. And I was school at 18, tan, you know, and they were like, well, how you so tan? Well, my vision and my hobby was I was a skinny kid. So I didn't want to be skinny. That's where my obsession for my body started. And I did not want to be skinny, so I wanted to be big. I didn't have any idea what it led to, but I didn't care. I was happier when I started looking good around 16 or 17 and putting weight on. And girls and guys and anybody noticing that I'm getting bigger, I liked that look. I wanted to be muscular. I didn't want to be Mr. Olympia. I didn't want to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. I wasn't that kind of thing, but I did want to, you know, I wanted to be fit and look good. And I did so in the middle of going to being massage therapy school. And I thought, you know, I think it would be cool to have a massage therapist and you see a guy that cares about his diet and what he eats and how he, you know, takes care of himself, and he's a good-looking boy and he's well-spoken and he cares and he's a very genuine, he's very nice, he's a Southern boy, he's a nice kid. I thought all those things were going to go for me. Well, they went dead against me, and women would walk in and see me and literally cancel. So here I am now. I've graduated. I paid $10,000 to go to massage school. I've graduated it, and it's backfiring in my face, and I don't know what to do. It's paying some bills, but it's definitely not going. I can see right away that it's not going to be a future job. It's just no way. There's my looks are not going to deter at 18, and I didn't see a winning of this massage therapy thing. It was really, now that I look back on it, 1,000%. And I wish somebody would have told me before I wasted $10,000, but massage therapy is for a good looking female. That is what it's for. It's for an average looking dude, or a feminine dude, or it's for a very attractive woman. And that's just a flat out facts, truth, the way I always talk, straight from the hip, because it just is too much. The women, you know, they'll say, oh God, I'd love a good looking hot dude massaging on me. They say that, but really truthfully, when you gotta take your clothes off and come into this room and the door closes, the attitude totally changes. And I caught the full realm of that and found out within about a year that it wasn't going to work. So I'm at the pool one day while my first wife is stripping to make us a living. I'm at the pool one day trying to figure out what we're going to do for a future at 18. And I see this blonde way across the pool, you know, and I'm like, you know, I can see she's a pretty girl, but no big deal. And you know, no waving or nothing like that. I get to see there was a pretty girl over there. Well, I go back to my apartment about an hour later, and she's moving in right across from me. And I'm like, that's kind of strange. What's the? Didn't even think two things about it. That night, knock at the door, and it's this blonde-headed chick at the door. And I told my first wife about it. I said, her name was Tanya, my first wife. And I said, you know, she goes, I said, is that blonde chick I told you about at the pool today, you know? And so I let her in, and she comes in, and we have no idea who this girl is. And she goes, hey, I'm Missy, nice to meet you. And she said, Sonya Tan in my hand. And she goes, I'm Missy Hyatt, I work for WCW. And we're like I've heard 10,000 times said to me, we said to her, we don't watch wrestling. I'm sorry. We watched it as kids. The same thing I've heard from 10 million people. We were saying to her, and she was, well, I'm Missy High and I work for WCW. And you know, your husband, I actually asked one of the agents when I saw your husband today to move me in next door to him. But the agent didn't know he was married, and I didn't know he was married, so I'm letting, so we're all laughing about it. She's obviously a cool chick. She's told on herself. She's cool, and we all become real good friends. And while we're talking, she says, listen, you know, why don't you be a wrestler? And I go, a what? And she goes, a pro wrestler. I said, oh my God, they don't make any money. And she goes, our lowest paid guy makes $100,000 a year. And I said, excuse me? And she goes, yeah. I go, she goes, wait a minute, let me back up here. She goes, it's really hard to get into. It's a very, I mean, I know you're tough and you may have done sports and stuff. I can see all the trophies and stuff. And she said, but this is a different type thing. You may get in the ring and hate it. You may love it. It really is very, very, very different. And I said, well, anything that pays a minimum of $100,000, I said, I'm going to give it a shot. So she leaves, and my wife is so excited. She's having us take her clothes off for a living to support us. So she's thrilled to death, and you know, Mars had a chance to go make $100,000 a year. And I'm, of course, trying to calm her down. And this is something that's very hard, obviously, or everybody would do it. And, you know, so I go to the school. I go down to WCW school, and Buddy Lee Parker's there, and Jody Hamilton's there, and which is Nick Patrick's father, you know, and everything. And, they're down there, and Kevin Nash walks in. I knew Kevin from Atlanta because he was the bouncer at Cheetah, and we were – there's, you know, probably 10 years between us, but still, we were still really very good friends. And, so Kevin walks in, we speak for a minute, and, I found out pretty quick, it's $3,000, which I don't have, and it's a dump. This place is a complete dump. So I'm like, oh man, this is crazy. So I come back home, and, you know, I tell Missy, look, it's $3,000, I can't afford that, this place was a dump. She said, well, let me see. So she found another guy that'll train for $1,500, and I get some friends together to round up the money and plus our money, and we get the money rounded up. And Steve, the brawler, we pay $1,500 to. He puts me in the ring about 10 times total. And my very first match was on television, and I was the TV champ on North Georgia Wrestling, which was Joe Pedicino's company at the time. And that's where, like, Jack Victory started, and Disco Inferno, and Scotty Riggs, and a lot of guys came through North Georgia. Joel Deaton, and, I mean, a lot of guys came through there, you know. And Billy Black. I mean, it was just a lot of good guys that come through there. But Tommy Rich. And so, you know, so I was at the plate, the best place you could be, you know, just trying to get trained. And but back to getting trained, I went to that for the first night I went. I came home and my wife was just thrilled to death. She was all excited. She goes, "How'd it go?" And I said, "I'm not going back." She goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life." I said, "I'm beat the hell up." This is back in the day when they didn't smarten you up. He didn't smarten me up at all. They literally, you know, beat me up for about 2 hours just to see if I'd take it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I went out there and got pushed and clotheslined for real and, you know, hitting the ropes and doing the squats and all that. I came home just, I said, "I ain't going back." And she just couldn't believe it because here's Marcus Bagwell, all state, all county, football, baseball player, Mr. Do It All, Marcus Bagwell. And I, after one time, I said, "I'm not going back." So she's like, "You gotta be kidding." I said, "I'm not kidding. I'm not going back." Well, something hit me, you know, a couple of days go by and I call the guy back up and I said, "Listen," I said, "I've already paid you. Let's give this, you know, give it a little more go. Let's try this some more." So I went the second time and it got a little bit easier. And of course, what I looked at after the first time, so you fully understand where I went, I looked at how I felt in a 2 hour period. Cause I was a very smart 18-year-old kid. And I looked at it and I said, here, I went out in the ring for 2 hours and I feel like this. And these guys do this 4 to 5 times a week. No off season. I said, this is not doable. I said, this ain't doable, bro. And so that's what I did. It wasn't so much I was beat up and I quit. It was more I felt the way I felt and did the math. And the math wasn't there, bro. It was like, this is not possible. I don't know how these guys do it. I had a whole new respect for professional wrestlers. I had no idea. And so I went back a second time, third time. Finally, I started digging it. I started liking it. I really did. And but then I didn't really start loving it until Global opened up. And I was still in Global happen. I still was at the stage of having matches that would literally make you turn your head and you were embarrassed. You know, those kind of matches I was still having when Global opened. And we get to Global, we fly out there, and we get in the locker room, and the heels and the baby faces are in the same locker room. And I go, "Wait a second, do you mean we can talk before the match?" And they said, "Yeah." I go, "Oh my God." So brother, I went from wrestler that was a super athlete to being able to talk about the match a little bit and map a few little things out to a damn good wrestler overnight. I was probably getting a little better along the way and didn't know it, of course, through the year long at North Georgia. But when Global happened and we could talk in the dressing rooms before the matches and not call it in the ring, man, my talent level went way up, and it went up real fast. Now we got Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, we got the Patriot, we got Chris, his name was so good, the Tarzan dude. Can't remember how I always forget his name. Wrestle Barefooted. And Chris Walker, Chris Walker. We got the Patriot. We got, Hall of Fame came there after me. We had Wild Bill Irwin. We had some serious talent out there, from older guys to young Black Bart. You know, we had older to all the way to the Handsome Stranger, to the Lightning Kid, which was X-Pac. So, I mean, we had a heck of a lineup, you know. That dude that was the pimp guy for WWE.
Oh, the Godfather.
The Godfather was the soul taker at Global. And so he was another guy that came from there. And out there, we were going to be the third company. I mean, this woman came in with a bunch of money, and she redid the Dallas Sportatorium. Redid the locker rooms, and everybody's excited, and you got Raven out there too. We got a really good card, a really good lineup. We're on ESPN. We got a good time spot. You know, 6 months later, it's out of business. You know, we're like, now what are we going to do? You know, so literally the day they called me to tell me they were done, the next day WCW called me. And it was Magnum TA that called me, and he said, "It's Magnum." And I said, "Magnum who?" He goes, "This is Magnum TA." And I was so green and so young, I really didn't really, really know who that was. But I remember hearing the name. I was that much of a wrestling watcher. I just didn't, it didn't hit me off the bat. I go, "Oh, hey, Magnum, I'm sorry." He goes, "Hey, Dusty, he's got a meeting, but he wants to see you." I said, okay, so I drove down, put my suit and tie on and everything, 18 years old, probably 19 at this stage. I'm 19, almost 20, and I drove down to WCW, the North Towers, and got over there and walked in. This is when WCW was yellow and purple, man, the first WCW.
Okay.
And Stinger was the only guy that had been there. Me and Sting were there the longest out of anybody on a consecutive number. And he was there the entire time. And I was there just under. I came in right after Crockett, had sold out. And the Crocketts actually worked for WCW. That was part of the sellout. They sold it to Turner, but part of the deal was they kept a job there. So there was a Crockett in production. There was a Crockett behind the camera. There was a couple Crocketts that worked for the company because that was part of the deal with Turner, and I was friends with all of them. They're really good people. And so I show up there, 19, almost 20, and I'm talking to Dusty. I am talking to Dusty Rhodes, but once again, knew who he was, but I didn't watch him on TV and want to be him and want to be a wrestler. I just saw something to make money at, and then I found it to be fun and intriguing. Then I learned to respect it. Most wrestlers, it goes the other way. They learn and set the ring up and pay their dues and all that. And then they become the wrestler. I became the wrestler, and then I learned to love it, respect it, enjoy it. But it was definitely a business. For me, it was when I showed up that day to Dusty Rhodes, I didn't know what a mark was, but I was definitely not a mark. I was at a business meeting to sign a contract for some money. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't there. Oh my God, in the room with Dusty Rhodes. Oh my God. It was, oh my God, I'm here to sign a contract for some money to pay the bills. And there's a big difference in that. There's only a few guys that were like that. And it's like Sting and Luger and even Nash. He was like that. But most, even your top talent guys, man, if you really ask them this question you asked me, they wanted to be a wrestler since they can remember. And that wasn't the way. But Dusty gave me a chance that day and signed me to like a weekly contract. 1 week into that deal, Barry Windham blew his knee out. They put me on the road to fill in. 28 years later, we're talking.
Now,
so that's how it went.
Now, throughout all this, and that's quite a story, by the way, Buff. Yeah, that is quite a story. Now, you know, through all this, you make it into WCW, and I wanted to bring this up since I had the honor and privilege of interviewing him on my show. It was about a good month and a half ago now. The Patriot, Del Wilkes, and I know that you and him were tag partners. Would you be willing to talk about your tag team run with the Patriot?
Absolutely. Me and Del are, I gotta be careful when I say this, but not too careful. Me and Del are, without a shadow of a doubt, through it all, we've remained the closest of friends through it all. Lex is pretty close, you know, Stinger's pretty close. I'm friends and love all those guys. The Styler boys live right next to me. I love them. But me and Dale, man, we don't even live close together, and we talk more than me and the Steiners, and they live a mile from me. You know, so I really, really respect Dale Wilkes tremendously. He is one of my best friends in the world. On one podcast we did about a year ago, for a guy named Brian, I can't remember his name, Brian Vaughn. Does that name sound familiar to you? Somebody with last name Vaughn?
It does sound a little bit familiar. I think I do know what you're talking about.
He's a real, real country boy that runs a podcast. Long story short, Dale Wilkes comes on as a guest on my podcast. And he goes off on what Marcus Bagwell, what happened to Marcus Bagwell. He says things that I wanted to say for years that there's no way I could say without people hating my guts and thinking I was the biggest prima donna in the world. And that was the truth. He said, Marcus Bagwell got screwed out of 15 years with the WWE, WWF, because of his looks. Because he's a good-looking kid, he gets it held against him, and they take away one of the best wrestlers that everybody in the world knows should have been on that team, should have been on the WWF television. They, because of his looks, they take 15 years away from Marcus Bagwell. But he just goes on and says it better. I swear to God, he says it 1,000 times better than I could have said if I was talking to God. I mean, it was incredible. When it was over, I was in tears. And I said, Dale, the only thing I know to say is thank you. You know, thank you for saying that. That really meant a lot to me. I said, I will back it up a little bit to get a little bit of heat for you. I said, I will back up and say, I agree with you. I think that's true. I don't think I got the proper chance. I mean, everybody in this business, almost everybody you can name has had a second chance. And I never had a second chance. And the sad part about it is, I don't know what I did wrong in the first place. And I really don't. I was a little screwed up I was hooked on pain medication, but so was everybody. They blamed it on Mom Caller. They blamed it on Booker T, our match. Come on, man. If you get all those things together and let's say they're all true, wouldn't you, don't you warn above that? Well, don't you hate Bub that you don't tell your mom that we're calling him, we're going to fire you? Hey, Bub, if you don't clean your act up in the ring, we're going to fire you. Or, I mean, isn't there some kind of warning or some kind of protocol? I gave them $60,000 that they owed me. I give that to Vince and show him I'm a team player by not sitting at home collecting the last 60 that WCW owed me. I jump ship early, save Vince $60,000, and I'm fired in a month.
Wow. See, and I
that's the kind of stuff that nobody hears about. Nobody knows about it. I told my agent. And I said, keep in mind, the WWF at the time, they didn't know Marcus Bagwell. You're talking to Marcus Bagwell right now. And anytime anybody talks to me on the phone, they're talking to Marcus Bagwell. There's no Buff. It's Marcus at all times. Buff Bagwell's the guy that comes out and put this top hat on, and when there's a red light on the camera, he turns Marcus Bagwell up as loud as he will go and exaggerates Marcus Bagwell to the absolute fullest, and that character's name is Buff. But this is Mark Bagwell talking to you right now, and it's Mark Bagwell 99% of the time, and that's why I have friends a lot of me, but unfortunately, and this is why I don't hate anybody up there, it's just facts. They never got to meet Mark. They heard about Buff Bagwell on the internet. So the only person they ever really met was Buff Bagwell Internet. Internet Buff Bagwell they met. And they had Buff Bagwell Internet in their minds when they're shaking Mark's hand. So it was going to take Mark a little time for them to see the Mark Bagwell. Well, Mark was only there for a month, and they only saw me about two or three times. And one of them was me and Helms got in a fight. And the other two times was a house show, and the third time was Tacoma. The fourth time was I got fired. So, you know, they literally only laid their eyes on me, I think, three times. We had to go to school that week. That was five times. So, Vince himself laid his eyes on me two or three times only. So, he never got to meet this Mark with this talking about now. He never got to meet this Mark. Johnny Yates knows Mark, but Johnny Yates didn't have no stroke back then. Johnny Yates was hired to bring in 12 WCW guys, and his head was on the chopping block. He had to get 12 guys over, and he had no stroke. But he knew Mark that well. So when I got in the head that day, I was looking at 11 meals, and I was looking at me. Knew me out of a whole company. So the whole company knows Internet Buff. they don't know Mark Bagwell. They know Internet Buff. Internet Buff was hard to get along with, called in trouble backstage. I mean, just like it was a thousand bad things, and none of them were true, just like the Internet. I mean, the Internet, if they talk about it, there's some truth to probably all of it. But it's not 100% true to none of it. So, they, like I said, the worst part happened to me was that it's never got a chance to actually meet Mark. But Miguel Wilkes, he really is a super great guy. I thought he made a great tag team. I love him to death. He's a super great guy. But he went on there and said that for me to help me out. To help me, I'm not here to help me. It didn't help me, but it made it. Somebody at least stood up and said it for me. You know what I'm saying? The things they talk about at Thanksgiving dinner with my family on what the WWF did to me, you know, Dale said on a podcast with thousands of viewers listening, you know, and that's a big deal. That's huge. And it meant a lot to me, and he's a great guy. I love him to death, and he's just a really, really good guy.
And you know what? That's how you know he's a true friend to you, to do something like that.
And man, Jesus, you're exactly right. And just as soon as I thought it couldn't get any nicer, he goes, and by the way, if you ever want to get lost ever in your life, get Mark Michael's car. And then the joke behind that, and you don't realize it because you're so young, but there wasn't any cell phone when we wrestled, bro. There wasn't no GPSs to the Gold's Gym. There wasn't no stuff like that, so you had to figure it out yourself. So I was really good at remembering everything and knowing where to go, so he was always in my...
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Oh. And it was just, it was like, so I always find that Mark Bagwell's car, you don't want to get lost, but he's a true, true friend, bro.
Oh, Dell is a great guy. Just sitting down and talking with him was a pleasure. And, you know, it's funny that you brought up everything, you know, with the WWF back in the day, because that was actually one of the questions that I had lined up. And, you know, now that you're on here on this platform, if you're comfortable, I definitely, you know, love you to speak out on this aspect of it, Mark. And that is, I watched this program. Well, I'll rewind a little bit. Like when I was 13 years old, I remember sitting in front of the TV and watching you wrestle with Booker T in Tacoma. And, you know, I was a fan of WCW. I watched you guys and always admired, you know, your work and what you did. And I thought that you were going to be a big part of the WWF, you know, going into the huge invasion angle and everything. And after Tacoma, I never saw you again, and I was like, what's going on? And then when the WWE Network came out, it was probably about a year or two after the network hit, they have this show called Legends with JBL, which is, John Bradshaw Layfield. He'll have a guest sit down with him, and they talk about things, and he had Booker T on the show. And they got to the part of the match with you and Booker in Tacoma, and I guess Booker, I heard him say a couple things as to, well, you know, he felt that, you know, you weren't conditioned enough, you weren't ready to go out there and do this or do that, and I'm, you know, and perform, and I'm just curious, you know, what is your view on that? Because, I want the scoop from you where it's real, you know, not some WWE propaganda that's on the other side of the television set.
Sure. And I will say exactly how I came down. This is exactly, anybody that knows, you know, Mark Bagwell knows that this is what you get ready to hear. It's like 90% of what happened. It is exactly 100% exactly the way it came down. And exactly what came down was me and Booker were told we were the main event on Raw. Both of us were like, are you kidding me? And let me rewind a little bit and tell you that after I got hit in the head with Helms, and the ideas of the wrestlers, all the wrestlers' ideas were, there's no way we're going to be able to keep this a secret. So when I get out, they convince me that they're all going to not say anything, and that we're going to keep this lie up that I slapped Shane Helms, and that Shane Helms hit me in the back of the head with an ice bottle, a water bottle, frozen like a brick, in the back of the head that caused 25 stitches and caused me to get, had to get cauterized because your head being split open, you got to cauterize it because of all the veins and bleeding.
Yep.
It was a brutal injury. And here these guys convinced me to stick to the line. So I didn't want to upset 11 guys. I wanted to be a team player, so I did it. We show up in Tacoma, Washington. Well, first night up, we show up in Seattle the night before. And me and Booker, as usual, go out and tear the house down. Don't miss a spot. I mean, just like every other match that you can go look at. Go right now. Anybody listening to this, go find, and you can find a bunch of them, a Booker T and Buck Bagwell match. And you will see nothing but absolute poetry and motion when me and Booker are in the ring. Absolutely, I beg somebody to prove me wrong and find one misstep that me and Booker made. And good luck, my friends, because you're not going to find it. Through Scorpio, through the American Males, and through Stars and Stripes, and through single matches, me and Booker T have tore the house down time and time again. In every several countries, and every state, period. So, me and Booker, we show up to Raw that day, and the first thing that happens is, I see Shane Helms, and remember, we're supposed to keep it a secret, and he's walking with the Hardy Boys, and I go, hey Shane, he didn't wave or say hello, and neither did the Hardy Boys. So as soon as that happens, I go straight to Johnny Yates and tell the truth. But at this stage, it's every man for himself, because I can see everybody is not going to what they said they were going to do, obviously. If the guy that hit me don't wave back at me. So I go straight to Johnny Yates, and I go, hey, Johnny, here's the deal, here's what happened. So we get all 12 guys together, and we told the truth, we all shook hands, we all made up, and everybody, you know, got on the same page, anything. Still, I don't know where we may have been wrong. But we're at Raw. So, right in that meeting, all of a sudden, it starts going around, and me and Booker are going to be made at the end of the invasion. The entire world does not know, and what the entire world does not take into consideration, was the next week, 7 days later, was Atlanta, Georgia. Now, let me ask you, like I've asked everybody else, if you were Vince McMahon and you really wanted to make money, and you really were out to make the WWF and the WCW work, and you picked Booker T and Buck Bagwell as your main event match, do you put that match in Tacoma, Washington, or Atlanta, Georgia?
You, without a doubt, without question, you put it in Atlanta, Georgia, because that's the home of WCW.
I mean, you can't think of anything better than having the invasion right in Ted Turner's face, right in his backyard, Buck Bagwell against Booker T at the Georgia Dome, sold out. I mean, this is poetry, this is great. But we're 7 days early and we're in Tacoma. And me and Booker know something's wrong. Why are they not waiting a week and doing this? Why are they going to put us in front of this crowd? But of course, nobody in here is talking about it. We're over in the corner talking to some election years. We're covering our mouths when we speak. And we assume they know what they're doing, so you can't question them. Hey, Vince, why would we wait a week? Who the hell's going to do that? Nobody. So you do as you're told, especially when you're an internet buff. I don't know so far. You're not Mark yet. You're an internet buff. are told. And that night, we were told to be main event on Raw. And we're like, totally blown away. We don't get it. But nobody ever comes to us. All of a sudden, we start out asking around, and all of a sudden, Stone Cold, which I was very good friends with, he was saying, seeing our company for years, and I wrestled him a thousand times, singles and tags, different tags, from Scorpio up. And he came to me, he said, all of a sudden, hey, listen, Shepard Fitness, he goes, sometime y'all come back. He goes, don't even worry about it, y'all just need to have a, he goes, just sometime during your going queue. He goes, if you're making your comeback, me and Kurt Angle are going to hit the ring. Get you guys out, and we're going to throw you guys out of the back of the building. And I said, okay, that's fine. I said, but we want you to kind of, you know, put a little bit of an argument, a little bit of a fight up before we throw you out, like you're on our team. I thought, that's actually really good. That's fine. I said, I like it. So not one person came to us and gave us a fix. I never worked for the WWF before. I didn't know how they did it. I didn't know how their position worked. I worked for one company for 11 years. It was called WCW. And there was a finish room, and you went in the finish room, and wherever the agent was, they told you what the finish was, and you went out and did it. And you got a 1 minute shoot to go home, or a 2 minute shoot to go home. And that's it. The rest of it's up to you. That last 1 or 2 minutes was your goal cue, and you took it home and you did the business that was laid out. The business that was laid out to us was we were getting beat up. I was enjoying them, and they were going to pull us out of the back of the building. And so we did so. We go out. We have a match that I looked at several times that I thought was not near as bad as people think, but it definitely wasn't up to me and Booker's kind of match. I mean, me and Booker are actually going to look at some matches. We've had some unbelievable, from world title matches to single matches. Me and Booker have had some great, great matches. And like I said, never miss a step during those great matches. So, we get the ring, but you also got to realize Booker goes out first. Well, first Sam and Man goes out. And there's 20,000 people booing. And then Safety Keeler walks out, and 20,000 people boo. And then Arn Anderson and Scott Hudson walk out, and 20,000 people boo. Booker T goes out first, and 20,000 people boo him. And right before I go out, my music starts once again. These are the things that nobody knows except a few people. Shane McMahon grabs me and goes, do not look in the camera. I go, what? He goes, don't look in the camera. I go, dude, my music is playing for live television and he's done this to me. And I go, Shane, that's all I do. All I do is look in the camera and talk to the camera. That's part of all that. Well, that's what I do. So if you watch Bagwell's entrance that night, it'll be the first time in several years you see me not talking to the camera. So I'm completely on my game. I'm not being buff. We're getting booed. I mean, it's really, we're main event on Raw. It's a pretty big deal that nobody's taking consideration here. And the main thing that I'm taking into consideration as a fans is that we know in a week we're in Atlanta, and we know something's up right now, or they wouldn't be doing this. So we're playing along knowing something's up. But we play along. We get in the ring. We do a match. There was no mess ups. It just really wasn't that good of a match. We were told to quit the ring. And then they said, wait, it's going to be a couple more minutes. And we had a spot in there. We got in his little spin slot. And his, leg kick. And we had a few things. And we're getting booed and everything else. And finally, here they come. They hit us, I join up, bring up Booker T, they go Booker out, I do the, hey, alright, yeah, they kick me, they throw me out. And then, after that, I'm thinking, great, that was a great little segment, okay, but now where do we go from here, you know? got beat by Dropkick, by Bob Holly, or whatever his name is. Is that his name, Bob Holly?
Yep, Bob Holly, yep. Oh my god.
So, pretty rough. I show up in Atlanta, giving the terminology, we got big plans for you, and I get fired. Jim Ross's fan. Jim Ross's fan and Steve Austin. Steve Austin didn't go to bat for me with this. After Steve Austin's podcast, he got Jim Ross looking on the phone and doing his podcast, and he went there. They didn't push it far enough because the interview you're talking about, there's another interview where Jim Ross is at a round table thing. And it's Jim Ross, Michael Vietes, Mike Graham, maybe Bischoff, and he dogs the fuck out of me. I mean, he rides me into the ground. But his comeback to Steve was, Steve, I like Mark. I had nothing against Mark at all. I was just doing my job. One of my jobs is a dirty job, and I was told to do my job, and if I got a call to fire somebody, I've got nothing against Mark. That is a fucking lie. And I told Jim Ross a flyer on every podcast I could call him on every video thing I call him, a fucking liar, because he is a fucking liar. Jim Ross dogged me out and then acts like he had nothing against me that time he called me. He knew he may not have been a repeating, of course, but to act like we're buddy, I'm after them say, I hated, I had nothing to do with it, but I hated Bagel's guts. Because that's exactly what he said in the interview. He said, who has her mother call me? Which is not even true, by the way. He makes that up, which everybody believes, because I have the heat of internet buff heat. And so everybody believes it. He creates this fabrication that everybody believes. And instead of going back to the basics of, why did you have it a week before in Tacoma? I mean, it all, every answer you could ask me, what about the match? What about your mother calling? Anything you could ask me, if you got it all together, don't equal doing the invasion the week before in Tacoma. You do it in Atlanta. Why would they do that? So we knew. So the next question you would ask, if anybody's listening to this properly, would be, well, why do they keep Booker and not you? It's a great question.
Exactly.
My answer is very truthful and from the hip like always. And that is, right now, even you cannot name five great black wrestlers. You can't do it. And if you do name them, you can't name them that can, they can talk, wrestle, and they have a body. There's not too many of them. I don't know any Ron Simmons. And so I think of, there's a few other ones. Help me. I mean, help me. Junkyard Dog was,
yeah.
I mean, he had no body. He was a gimmick.
Ahmed Johnson.
I mean, Ahmed Johnson, which now is in the top eight worst bodies they kept up with themselves ever. Really guys that really had it all. Have you heard Ahmed Johnson do an interview?
You know what? I've never heard Ahmed Johnson do an interview as of yet. I have not heard
it. So that's not, thank you for saying that. So think about the question again. A guy that can interview, a guy that can wrestle, and a guy that can, that looks good. You can't name three black dudes. And Booker T had it all. He was fantastic in the ring. He could talk. He had a great body. So we've got to have a Mexican. We've got to have a midget. We've got to have a girl. We've So we gotta have a little bit of all of it. You gotta have a black guy. You gotta have a little bit of everything to make it work. And so for drawing power, you gotta draw that population. You gotta have a Spanish person with a Spanish. You gotta have a girl to draw some women. You gotta have a midget to draw that kind of power. You gotta have a little bit of it all. It's like a carnival. You gotta have a little bit of it all. And Booker T was the best. He was the Tiger Woods of pro wrestling. And everybody knows it. So that's why he made it. And that's keep in mind. And that is, which is my opinion. But that is a pretty damn good one. And I can't think of two other guys. I can't think of anybody, really, to be honest with you, that is even remotely as good as Booker T. Body, wrestling, and interviewing.
I mean, I agree with you 100%. You know, Booker T was very special. He really, you know, really was. I mean, he did have it all like you're talking about.
He really did, dude. And I'm not saying that's the reason why, but I'll tell you this. He was the first one out of the 12 that he... They went to him first, and he just—he had to go out, do something in Austin's rip match, and then he had to throw Austin on a table, and he actually missed, and Austin didn't land right, and he messed his elbow up. So Booker had the first heat of really—I keep saying 12. It's really three. It was me, Booker, and DDP. That was the first three names that they brought up. They brought up 12 guys, and out of that 12, you gotta realize there's a bunch of guys sitting home getting paid and ain't gotta do nothing. The reason you saw Booker, Backwell, and DDP first is because our contracts were up. That's the only reason. The reason you didn't see your Goldbergs and your Rugers had nothing to do except with the almighty dollar. And if I had $1 million coming for WCW, I'd have sent my brother home too. But when I had just 60, you know, I'm not exactly sure exactly how much it was, but it was between 60 and 80 grand I could stay at home and made. And then, once that much gas pays out, then we go to the contract that that's made up for you. So, I called my agent up and said, I got a way to maybe get some of this heat off of us. And I come up with, let's let Vince not have to pay me that money and show it on a team player, and maybe it will show that, you know, maybe we'll get some of the heat off of me. And my agent goes, oh my God, that's the smartest thing you have said. That's great. I was fired in 2 weeks. So obviously it didn't work.
I mean, what in the world was even their reason, you know, to fire you? I mean,
they never gave me one. And I even asked. I said, well, first of all, when I was getting fired, I couldn't believe it. It caught me off guard. So I raised my hand. I didn't know what else to do. So I raised my hand, and Vince goes, you don't got to raise your hand more. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I just felt like I should raise my hand. I said, are y'all firing me? And Booker's just like, as you know how good they are, without even a pause, Jim Ross goes, oh, no, Mark, we're not firing you, we're releasing you. And I raise my hand again. And Jim goes, Mark, you don't gotta raise your hand. I go, Jim, what is the difference of getting released and getting fired? Now I'm thinking, they can't answer this. There's no way they can answer this question. There's no difference in getting released and getting fired. I was wrong. They answered it, and it was real good. And they said, well, if we fire you, we got to redo your contract. And if we release you, when we bring you back in 3 months, wink, wink, we don't got to redo your contract. And as soon as I heard, 3 months, we're going to call you back, I knew it was over. So I said, try not to cry. Shake their hands with the finger as soon as you can before you cry. So I got up. I thank you for the time, and I said, what exactly, before that happened, I said, what exactly am I getting released from? And they said, Mark, we have a great idea here. This is something we're definitely going to pursue. WCW versus WWF is going to work, no doubt, we know it. But we just pulled the trigger on it a little too fast, and, you know, the locker room is just really rough, and, you know, guys getting along, and it's just everybody's really not, you know, it's just a little bit rougher than we thought. We're going to let it rest a little bit, and then we're going to bring you back in 3 months and give it another go. And, of course, I knew I wasn't coming back in 3 months, but I did what they told me to do. So they told me to call them back in 3 months. So I got my bags, and I got out there as fast as I could, trying not to cry. And the last person I saw, God rest their souls, was Warren and Chris Benoit. And if you check your record somewhere, let's see, February, March, September, October, sometime in July is when I got fired, because I would say July 15th, please, July, see, August. I guarantee you, if you go back and look at, and you have some kind of way to look at their paperwork, I was fired on July 15th, 2001, because October 15th of 2001, that was my last day. That was when my paycheck stopped. They gave me 3 months severance. So 3 months from July 15th would be August, September, October, no, man. Oh, wait a minute, it was August, October, see, July, August, September, yeah, I said exactly right, August, September, October, 3 months, so July 15th I got fired, October 15th was my last day on paper, and I flew out to Australia on October the 16th to wrestle for WWE and Andrew McManus and World Wrestling All-Stars.
Wow. You know what, this story is so amazing, and I really do thank you for sharing it with me, and I'm just thinking, wow, with all this to digest. And, you know, it's exactly true what you said, you know, a little bit earlier. When you are running a multi-billion dollar industry, like the WWE, well, WWF back in those days,
right.
Vince McMahon buys WCW. You would think, regardless of the hard feelings of the Monday Night Wars, regardless of all that, you would think that now that he has it in his possession, he would want to do something with it to make it prosper, to have it make so much money where he would be collecting from it. And it's like he did the complete opposite. It's like he put you guys in Tacoma to literally kill WCW.
And we did it. We killed it in one night. And instead of him looking like he killed it, he tried to paint the picture that me and Booker killed it. And you know what? People bought into it. They believed it. They believed that a bad... Listen to this sound. Listen to this sentence. They believed... The people believed that a bad match could get Buff Bagwell fired. That's ludicrous, bro. They believed that by my mother calling, supposedly, let's say she did call. Let's say she did.
Okay.
My mother calling them up gets Buff Bagwell fired? You don't fire Buff Bagwell because his mom called. You don't fire Buff Bagwell
people because he had a bad match. Now, you may fire Bob Battle if you warn him when his mother calls and she continues to call. You may fire Bob Battle if you tell him to tighten his matches up and he still gets worse than the ring. But you don't fire Bob Battle after what he done in this business over one match. You know and I know that you took a worldwide poll on should Marcus Bagwell have been in the WWE the last 15 years, it is going to be in the high 90 percentile that the answer is yes. And you know that. And I know that because I got a computer that I got to answer people to. Then I got my first way to TNA was I handed him 10,000 emails. I handed to Jeff Jarrett and I said, tell me what to say to them. He goes, what do you mean, bro? I go, here's just 10,000 of what I got to read and look at. So I just grabbed 10,000 for you to look at if you got time. I said, but tell me what to say. I'm running out of things to say. I said, I've said, they're talking to me. I'm coming. I've not said nothing bad about you, nothing bad about TNA. I've tried to be politically correct with WWF. I've never said a bad thing. There's nobody that can pull up anything about me ever saying anything bad about this man. I respect him. I think he's a genius. I hate Jim Ross's guts. That's a separate issue. I've got nothing against anybody in this business, not even Shane Helms. They hit me with a ice brick because I'm the one that caused it. And plus that, even though you know, I wasn't looking, it's still my fault. I don't blame anybody or hate anybody in this business, but I hate Jim Ross for lying and ruining, at least being part of ruining my wrestling career. He literally took millions and millions of dollars out of my hand, bro. And now whether he was part of it or not, I can't say, but to sit there and lie and say that he liked me and was friends with me and we were buddies and went on that round table thing and dogged me out, go get it, it's called the Heat Seekers. It's a 3-disc DVD and I'm on the front of it with Sergeant Slaughter, Ric Flair, Junkyard Dog, a couple other guys are on there. And me and Lex's CD, of course, says the Heat Seekers. But it's a round table thing that they host all 3 discs. And when it comes to my disc, he dogs me out. For him to sit there and say, oh, I've got nothing against Bagwell, that's a lie. So he's lying about that. Then he's hiding something because you cannot like me and do your job and call and fire me. That's fine. But don't say you like me and you got nothing against me when I got you on tape saying that who has their mother calling him? Who is he anyway? He's not even any good. I mean, it's brutal how he talks about me. Mm. And then to say that he had nothing against me is a flat out lie, dude. So whether it was 1%, or 50% or 80%, he had a percentage in on running my career. And I hate his guts for it. And the reason why I can't hate somebody else for it is because I don't know anybody. There's nobody else I know that was involved. And I'm not a name thrower. I don't make things up. I believe nothing of what I hear, and I believe of half of what I see. So I know for a fact that Jim Ross dogged me out and then said I have no problems with him. So he's lying about something. I don't know anybody else that was involved in it. So I have nobody else to blame but Jim.
And you know what? It absolutely sounds like he has something to hide and that he does have something against you because of just his actions. And you know,
that's it. To be honest with you, let's take Jim off the hook for a second. You she's in Tacoma. There's a lot more to this than either one of me and you ever know.
Exactly. And you know what?
We'll never know the true story of why me and Booker wrestled in Tacoma. There's no reason we should have done that.
And you know what? I think the only ones that know that story, if I were to guess right now, is Jim Ross, because of obviously the way he treated you. And I believe Vince McMahon knows because it's his company. He runs it all. So he probably has the answer behind that as well. Because I remember.
Yeah, I've really tried to put it all together several times over the years, you know, and the first, you know, 5 or 6 years, it was really hard. And then it became pretty simple, but it still just blew my mind that on such a high percentage person that everybody knows should have at least been there 10 of the last 15 years, on the absolute worst case scenario, I should have been there 10 of the last 15. That's something more that we're never going to find out the truth to, bro. And it goes back to Shane McMahon grabbing me and going, don't look in the camera. Why would he wait? I'm going to walk out to have to tell me that. You think he forgot it all day? So he got there at noon and just decided to tell me when he heard my music come on? Why, hell no, he didn't. He knew that. He waited for that just at the right time, and it worked. Bravo to them. Their plan worked. But damn it, man. Was it really worth ruining a guy's career that could have made you money? I don't understand. Why do you want to take a buck battle away from it that could have made you money? I don't understand, but it's just, the only thing I can blame it all was, like I said, they didn't get a chance to meet Mark. And you know what? Mark is a really good guy, man. Mark is a really truthful-speaking, down-to-earth, good guy, dude. And it's sad to the ones that know Mark to know what happened to me. Like, and that's why Dale Wilkes said what he said that day, because they know Mark, and they know Mark well. And for Mark Blackwood to get done this way, it bothers them. My father can't talk about it without crying, bro. And it's just something they did to me that should have never been done, man. It was an injustice. And it quit hurting a long time ago, but it still is just amazing to me. It really is. That they didn't give me another chance.
Yeah.
Or something, keep in mind, over something that I don't know what I did in the first place. You know, give me a second chance to first tell me what I did wrong so I can fix what I did wrong.
Exactly. And they never even gave you a straight up answer either.
Never, brother. Right now, if you got fired from McDonald's tomorrow, you would want to know why, because it's human nature. I got fired from $1 million a year job. Do you think I want to know why I got fired? Well, you damn right I want to know. And it kills you when somebody don't want you. If you get broke up from a girlfriend and she don't tell you why, it would drive you crazy. Everybody wants to know why you failed. Why are we not together? Why don't you like me? Why am I not there? Everybody wants to know why. When you lose your career, it would be really nice to know why you lost it.
Exactly.
I don't even know why, brother.
And I gotta tell you, you know, my heart goes out, you know, to you. I feel for you, believe me. And this is the first, you know, I've talked to you a couple of times on the phone leading up to this interview. And as I'm talking to you now and I'm hearing everything, and I gotta tell you what you said about Mark being a good guy, I gotta say myself, you know, big T to Mark. Mark, you're one hell of a guy.
I appreciate it, man.
And you're straight up, just like you say you are, And you know what? We'll never know what happened going into this, and it's, you know, it's unfortunate. And
you know, what happens is what we end up doing, and it's something that I live my life by, and a lot of people do live their lives by this. And I think it's something really good, and that is everything happens for a reason, brother. Everything. And if you don't believe that, you've got a long road ahead of you. There is somebody, whether you believe in God or not, there is somebody of a higher power definitely running this show, brother. And it's for a reason. And it all makes sense because there's way too many lies out there. And that's the first thing that hit me when I became a Christian several years ago was, you're not supposed to ask. Nobody ever told me this. I just feel this in my heart. You're not supposed to ask why. Why is that little boy retarded? Why did my mom die in the car wreck? Why did I get fired from the WWF? You're really not supposed to ask why. We are talking about it and we're curious. And of course we would like to know why. Everybody wants to know why they failed. But it does all happen for a reason. And you gotta go with that reason. We don't know for a reason. And that's just the way you gotta live life. That's the way I live it. And it's all happened for a reason. I would not go back and do nothing different whatsoever. I walk every step of the way. I, of course, wish to God I could have had a run at WFBF and had some more fun with the business, but I had a career that only a very, very, very small amount of guys have, bro. And I had a damn good run and had a lot of fun, and I still do. And you know, I just, you know, the old saying, I go by, and everybody goes by. It can always be worse. And that's the one that I hate. It's definitely the truth. It can always be worse, mother. And that's why you gotta just take your deal with the bad and go with it. And that's what I've done. I'm very happy in my life right now. I've been sober for 3 years. I feel great considering hair replacement and shoulder replacement. I think I still look great considering being 47 and 2 major surgeries this past year. I still stay very busy. I still work in the ring, wide open, you know, with the tights, boots, tape it up and go to the other boys as best I can still. And I still do this. And so I'm just doing what I gotta do. I'm very excited about what I do still. I still love what I do. And that's why I do stuff like this. Just to, you know, because I don't care if you told me, hey man, I got 10 listeners, I would have done it because I'm a nice guy and I like to do what people ask and I follow up on the things I say I'm going to do and just like I did with you. And there's several times I know you don't know what you're doing, so never call me back. And I called you back every time and we said this day that and we did it. And so I appreciate you hanging with me. And I'm really very busy, but I'm very honest. And you hung with me, and we got it done. And I hope you had a good time doing it. And we do it again sometime soon.
Yeah, I definitely had a great time. One thing I did want to say while we're on the air, if you'd ever be interested in, you know, coming back on one day and talking, you know, about things in WCW, you know, about your career there and some matches you had and maybe like the final Nitro and all kinds of things like that about WCW reliving everything. I would love to do it.
Absolutely, we will. We'll get together. We'll definitely do another date. And with you, next time we do it, even though we had a good interview, with you, next time you may need to, you know, just
No problem, Mark. And like I said, I told this to Del Wilkes, and I want to tell it to you on the air here right now. I told Del Wilkes that when he came on this show might have my name on it. It might be called the Beyond the Ring with Big T Wrestling Podcast. But when guests like you or guests like Del come on, it is your show now, Mark. This is your show. This is your platform to tell your story, and that's why, you know, I'm letting you roll with it, man. And this show's all about you to get your side of the story out and, you know, tell your side.
So I appreciate it. But next time we'll definitely focus on getting, you know, 3 or 4, maybe 5 answers answered more than just a couple. But I really appreciate your time, and we'll set another time up soon for sure. And I really appreciate it, man. I really enjoyed it.
Hey, I appreciate it too. Thank you so much for coming on tonight. And if it's okay with you, would it be all right if I shoot you a text next week or give you a call and we try to plan something out? Yes, exactly. You know what? I have no problem with that. I'll definitely get something together. I'll talk with you about it, and we'll set something up. And I'm just so happy that I was able to be, you know, here tonight to get you on here and let you tell your voice about this whole story. And I'm glad you did. Thank you so much for sharing it. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate you. Just give me a text next week, and we'll hook up another day, brother.
All right, sounds good, Mark. You have a great night, brother.
You too, pal.
All right, good night.
Bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, there you hear it. This was absolutely just fantastic. A great interview. Honestly, I'm left speechless myself. A big thank you to Marcus Buff Bagwell for coming on the show tonight. And I'm very happy that he was able to tell his side of the story. So big thank you to Mr. Marcus Bagwell for coming on the podcast tonight. And please just, you know, if you're joining in right now and you're listening and, you know, say you missed part of the show, make sure you go back and listen to it all, because this is just absolutely fantastic. This is a great interview that you guys just, you don't want to miss any of it. And I am looking so forward to having Mark back on the show. So look forward to having Mark Bagwell back on the show, hopefully within the next couple weeks or so, and we'll talk more about his career. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in, and I will talk to you guys very soon. And another big thank you to Marcus Buff Bagwell. You are awesome, brother. Thank you for coming on the show, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I will talk to you soon. And good night, everybody.